We talked to a seven-year-old in a focus group about being in Roblox and being locked in a basement trying to get away from a man who kept trying to take his clothes off, and how scary it was. And you can imagine how terrifying it was. But, you know, she just wanted to play the game. And she wanted, you know, and this was really taking away from the enjoyment of that game.
Hello and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest today is Alex Cooney, Chief Executive and Co-Founder of CyberSafe Kids, a charity that aims to empower children, parents, schools and businesses in a very challenging online world. She has worked in the international development sector with agencies such as the United Nations Development Programme in East Timor and also the Catholic Agency for Overseas Development with its Southeast Asia programme. She has brought that same concern for social justice back to Ireland in the area of cyber safety. With the fast-paced development of AI and Australia's recent ban on certain social media for under-16s, it's a busy time in this field. Alex Cooney, you're welcome to the Insights podcast. So much to talk about. I haven't even scratched the surface of your CV. But to begin with, you were actually born in Scotland. So how did the Irish connection and experience and background come about?
Yeah, I was born in Scotland. I was raised in the north of England. And then I used to come here on holiday as a child because we had obviously Irish family. So we would visit the west of Ireland in the summer. And that connection kind of encouraged me to look at doing a master's here in Dublin, which is what I ended up doing. So I did a master's at Trinity in peace studies, international peace studies, where we looked at kind of international development and conflict and, you know, the ethics of peace and so on. And that was absolutely fascinating. So I spent a year doing that. And then kind of stayed. I mean, I've spent time away as well. I worked in international development for a good chunk of my career. So I was spent time overseas. I was based in London for a while. But ultimately, you know, we decided, my husband's Irish, we decided to come back and settle here. My parents also moved here about 25 years ago. It very much felt like home.
You mentioned the west of Ireland. I mean, whereabouts in the west of Ireland? And then there was also, I think you settled in Cork, I think, family-wise. So
My parents settled in North Cork. Yeah, no, we used to go to Kilkee in County Clare, where my grandfather was from. So we would enjoy spending time in the Pollock Holes and enjoying the good weather and the sea there.
And what then was your start in the not-for-profit sector?
Pretty early on, actually. I took a year after I left school to work in the US on a kind of in a charity. It was like a sort of social justice charity working with the poor and the homeless. So it was providing services and supports. And so I spent 6 months working there and traveling around the US. And then I went to college in Edinburgh, back to Scotland. And in my summer time, I did projects. So I did a project in Zimbabwe, which was like a student project working in a village. So I kind of always had that interest. And then I when I started working, I was in London and I just found myself desperate to travel and get away. And I didn't want to be based in London. And so then I decided to do that master's and I came to Dublin to do the master's. And from then I was kind of worked in places like Romania and East Timor and Jamaica. And I traveled a lot, which was fantastic. But when we eventually came back to Ireland, I had small kids. So the traveling side of it, my job had always involved quite a lot of travel and it just wasn't feasible with small kids. So then I started to look at what might interest me kind of nationally.
And before we get back to Ireland, as it were, Alex, the kind of work you were doing, I mean, for instance, you mentioned about being in Jamaica. That was to do with resettlement of prisoners being, if you like, sent back there from various countries, including the UK.
Yeah, the UK, the US, Canada. It was like returnees. So Jamaican nationals who'd committed crimes in other territories being returned to Jamaica, but often they'd been years, sometimes most of their lives out of Jamaica. They hadn't got a network. They didn't necessarily have things like a social security number or a means to work. So the idea was to have a program that would support them and avoid falling back into a life of crime. So it was a British government funded program. And so I was working on that, which was really interesting. and we supported local NGOs who were providing those services. So sometimes it was, you know, short or medium term accommodation. It was, others were kind of job seeking opportunities, that sort of thing.
So coming back to Ireland with two young children, obviously that limited your options. But what kind of outlook or attitude did you have in terms of the type of work you thought you would want to do when you got back here?
Yeah, I mean, I've always wanted to do work that was fulfilling, you know, that felt like it had a clear purpose. So I think I've been drawn to that throughout my career, you know, whether it's working on, you know, international development, HIV and AIDS, or sustainable development, or climate justice, things like that. And I got to work on, in all of these different areas. So moving back to Ireland, yeah, it was very much with a social justice focus. And in the end, I started this charity with my co-founders, so Dr. Cliona Curley and Dr. Maggie Brennan. They had worked together or crossed paths in the UK when they were working on things like cybercrime. So Cliona was working on the kind of cybercrime investigation side. Maggie is an academic who has worked a lot, you know, advising organisations like Interpol on things like child sexual exploitation. So they had this background. And we all had young kids, and essentially we saw the levels of access that children had. Cliona was actually volunteering in schools at the time, and she is very persuasive, and she persuaded me that we needed to do something about this real need to equip children to be online in a safe way.
That was just over a decade or so ago you founded the charity. It started off, I think, as Cyber Safe Ireland, now Cyber Safe Kids. And what kind of objectives did you set yourselves?
So really, initially, we had this education focus. We didn't have a lot of ambition beyond, you know, this need to educate and equip children. So we started in September 2015. I think by January 2016, we'd launched our first education program, started going into schools locally. Cliona was doing that side of it. She developed the education content, consulted with a charity in the UK on the content, and started rolling it out. And yeah, it was going into schools, talking directly to children, talking to teachers. Increasingly, we saw a need to also talk to parents, because obviously parents are at home. They're often the decision makers around when children are getting that access, you know, the extent of the access they have, and so on. So we increasingly saw that need. We realized that the parents that were coming to our talks were what I would describe as the worried few, and we needed to get to a broader range of parents. We knew that parents in general felt really overwhelmed by the idea of kind of trying to parent their children through this digital world when they hadn't grown up with it themselves. So we started then these campaigns, which we've continued to run to provide kind of more like kind of a public awareness focus. So we run a Same Rules Apply campaign, which we'll run again in February. We do a Cyber Break campaign, which is about taking, you know, looking at a healthy balance to technology use in the household. We publish our trends and usage data, which is data we've been gathering almost since the outset from children directly, but also from parents and teachers. And then it became clear over the years that we needed more than education, that you know, educating and equipping children was vital, but it wasn't the only thing.
So at that stage, I mean, at what point did you realise or conclude that you needed maybe to get into the business of lobbying or trying to persuade policymakers and decision makers and government that they needed to take certain steps?
I think it was seeing the vulnerabilities that children, you know, how vulnerable children are online. And you can do everything in your power to, as I say, educate and equip them. But essentially, if they're going into inherently unsafe environments, then there are still going to be problems. And at the end of the day, the online world was not designed with children in mind. It was designed for adults by adults. So you've got this real lack of safeguards. You know, it's often described as the Wild West. And that's you know, those are the environments that children are going into, and really from quite a young age. And when I talk about it's that more independent access that I'm talking about. And we were seeing children as young as 8 with quite an amount of independent access, you know, with a range of devices, so a tablet, a games console, sometimes even a phone, social media accounts, gaming accounts. And really often not getting the levels of supervision and support that, are so important.
That in the 10 or so years that you've been active, that maybe parents and to an extent children as well have become more aware of the need to limit access and to limit usage, and to be more, I suppose, smart about how they use social media and the online world?
So yes, in that absolutely awareness is increasing. Like, we have seen that change. But I would also say that the technology is evolving all the time. So even in the last 2 or 3 years, you're seeing, you know, the generative AI become a much bigger feature of our lives, much more integrated into the day-to-day technology that we're using anyway. And again, children are on the back foot on that one. We, you know, we're only just starting to put regulation in place, and oftentimes it's not covering this new, these new tools, these new apps, and it's, you know, insufficient to meet the need. So we are seeing a shift. We are seeing an increasing awareness. Interestingly, over the last, let's say, 2 years in particular, we've seen more parents coming together. Sometimes it's led by the school, sometimes it's led by the parents, but it's around that primary school stage where parents are saying, you know, maybe if we all agreed that we could hold off on, you know, giving them the smartphone or giving them access to certain social media sites, it will be easier.
So, yes, and banning the use of them, or the presence of them in classrooms,
yeah,
whatever kind of phone you're talking about. Or
right, sort of having clearer rules within the school environment, but also agreeing that, you know, a child maybe doesn't need a smartphone until they finish primary school and are going into secondary school. There are also more alternatives now on the market. So if you are a parent choosing a device for your child, you've more options, you know, options that have really limited connectivity. They give you kind of maybe the ability to call your child or you know, track your child, but they don't connect to the internet in the same way. So they're a kind of safer option for a younger child, let's say, or phones that have limited, you know, access. You know, they're more shut down, you know, like the balance phone or something.
A lot of attention in recent times has focused on the Australian government's decision to ban under 16-year-olds from access to social media and putting the onus on the platforms and the companies to check their identities, to verify their ages and so forth. What do you think of that and how it's been working, or has it been working?
Well, it's very early days. I mean, it literally came into effect in December. So I would say it's too soon to say whether it has been an effective approach. What I would applaud them on, the Australian government, is their leadership in this area. You know, we're all talking about this and you know, concerned about it, and certainly countries are exploring different avenues. They've actually gone ahead and done something. I think the way it was initially kind of framed as a ban probably wasn't helpful. I think if we talk about minimum age, it's a better approach. It's quite a limited approach. So it's banning children from certain online apps. YouTube is a good example. It's one of the most popular online apps for under 13s, for example. But you can still access it through a browser. So it's not really banned. And actually, most children will go through a browser, you know, because they can avoid any kind of parental controls that their parents might have put in place on the app. So you can, you know, They'll find a workaround. Or it doesn't include any gaming platforms. And we know that a lot of gaming platforms have a lot of social media features, you know, the connecting, the sharing, the linking. Those are all there in those gaming environments as well. And it doesn't include those. It doesn't include AI chatbots. So they have given themselves scope to increase the number of apps, but I feel we would be better with a different approach where we really look at the risks posed to children in different online environments. So if you take something like Roblox, which is the number one most popular online environment for an under 13 in Ireland, which we know from our data, it has a minimum age rating of 5 or something like that. To
That's
my mind,
Roblox.
Roblox, yeah.
It sounds a bit like roadblocks.
Roblox, yeah. It's hugely popular, and I think that something like Roblox should have to prove that it is safe for whatever age it is putting. You know, that there is some sort of external analysis about whether or not it is indeed appropriate for a 5+, or what features of it are appropriate for a 5+. So kind of working within the language of the Digital Services Act, which is this European-wide legislative framework that we have, which talks about risk. It also talks about proportionate to size, which means that Roblox actually doesn't come under their very large online platforms, which means it's not subject the more stringent regulation. So I think we really need to be focusing on where children are going online and whether or not they are safe and appropriate.
What
for
is
them.
Happening with Roblox that causes you to be concerned?
Yeah, bad actors online being able to access children. They know where children go in large numbers, and if they can relatively easily access them, then you know that's where they will go.
How can they be fended off, though?
Well, age verification, much more, you know, you could have a zero tolerance approach on the part of these platforms. Some of them actually facilitate access. If you look at some apps, you know, they actually actively promote friendships that, you know, may or may not be or loosely in your network, maybe a friend of a friend of a friend. You know, we need to really shut down these opportunities, these avenues, if we're now, Roblox is talking about, and from January, so from now, they should be age verifying everybody, is what they say, and that you will only be in an experience with other people who are of a similar age.
Yeah, but that's one of the things, though, Alex, that age verification, I mean, if you go back to the Australian experience of what they've started, that they say, well, look, you know, one way of verifying age is to put up a picture of yourself and then they will assess it and say, well, you know, you don't actually look like you're over 16, but you can get a friend who's 17 to put their face in the picture and, you know, you're out the gap, so to speak. So how do you actually, how can you make something like age verification fail safe?
So they ran a trial last year before this law became into effect in December. They ran a trial over several months and different companies could apply to be part of that trial. I think over 80 companies took part, including Irish companies, by the way, who had different types of age verification solutions. Some of them involve facial recognition technology. Some involve a combination. So, and it's divided into categories. So there's age verification where really you need kind of government ID type info to verify age. It's a very black and white check. But obviously there is issues there in terms of privacy and who owns that data, you know, who has access to that data. Then you've got kind of age assurance and age estimation, which maybe aren't quite as black and white. You know, they're more, and then that could be based on a facial recognition or an age token maybe that you've got. But this trial basically concluded that it didn't specify one approach over another, but it did conclude that the technology had reached the threshold, that it was, you know, based on the parameters that they had laid out, you know, in terms of privacy preservation, data retention, policies around data retention, that it had, you know, met the criteria there. And it ran, you know, went through the various aspects of the trial. So there is a detailed report. So we do know that this technology has reached the kind of level it needs to get to be used effectively. The one thing that we haven't done, which I think we need to do, is before we kind of rush ahead and say, right, just age verify, which is kind of what the Australians have done. They've not specified how they do it. They just need to say, they need to be effective, right? They're not saying who should own that process. We think it should be a trusted third party provider. So it shouldn't be the big tech companies who get to own this process and more of our data. It shouldn't be our government, obviously, because then you have real concerns around the sort of big brother aspects. It should be trusted third parties who have to apply to be part of a process. They get accredited for a period of time and then they have to go, you know, keep applying over time to show that their technology still meets the threshold.
So how would that fit in with the government's, again, it was announced or re-announced in the last few weeks or so, bringing forward this plan for later this year for a digital wallet? Just explain what that would mean.
So the digital wallet is part of a wider European rollout, and it is based in other countries around a government ID, kind of like a public services card type ID. Now, we don't have an equivalent that everybody has to have in Ireland, so we need a kind of alternative approach. But it is in process. My understanding is this will be a tool. It will be an option to use. If you want to put in an age verification solution, you can use the national identification wallet. But it isn't compulsory. So it is going to be voluntary. So we'll have the tool, but we won't have necessarily the mechanism to say you must use this tool. So it'll be one of the options available. So in Ireland, we do have an online safety code that has age assurance as a requirement. So in our online safety code, which applies to entities that are based in the state, so they've a list of, I think, 10 entities, the likes of Google, TikTok, Meta's, Instagram and Facebook, not Snapchat because they're not based in the state. No gaming platforms because they're also, well, A, they're not video sharing platforms, but B, they're not based in the state. So it is limited to this list of entities based in the state. And in theory, from now, they should be putting in place age assurance measures, highly effective age assurance measures. But there's no, they're not being prescriptive about what those measures are or who puts them in place. So Google could put their own solutions in place, for example, rather than use the digital wallet.
But you would want this to be overseen or at least organized or curated by this trusted third party provider you're talking about.
Yeah, there are various companies who provide age verification solutions. So I think that it should be a European wide, you know, open up to the European market that these can apply to be part of this process, and that company, that big tech, because of the trust issue around how they manage our data, that that would actually really work against them in this process. So, you know, they can apply, but it would be a problem for them that they're
yeah,
not trusted.
You can always, the fear would be, I suppose, that you would get some sort of infiltration of the trusted third parties arrangements by way of cyber attack or whatever. And, you know, how do you legislate against that?
So there is a vulnerability on any age verification solution. But if you think about it, in banking, we have long used these processes to, you know, scan information in a, you know, in the background to ensure, you know, fraud isn't happening or whatever. So we have got this real, there's a real block here in terms of privacy. And of course, any solutions need to prove that they are privacy preserving and that they've got extremely effective ways. So one age verification provider or solution provider talk to me about that they hold the most minimal amount of data possible, and it's broken out into sort of many different components. So it would be very difficult to put the bit of data that they hold against one person, you know. So I think that's part of the process that they need to go through to prove that their solution is highly effective at all of these different in all of these different areas.
And you emphasise the need to approach these things on a Europe-wide basis, but it's the worldwide context as well. We've got to look at it. Was it on Christmas Eve, I think it was, that the White House imposed visa bans on five public figures in Europe, including a former EU commissioner, Thierry Breton, who was responsible for regulating social media and a key architect of the Digital Services Act, and the White House objecting to what Europe is doing on the basis that it's censorship and stymieing free speech.
I know. It's really challenging in this current context. And President Trump has made it clear that he doesn't want Europe to put too many guardrails in place because that it will stymie innovation. And there, especially in the area of AI technology, they really, really want to be the first to the finish line. And it's kind of they're in a race with China. But the reality is, and in fact, my understanding is he signed an executive order to put a moratorium on regulation of AI in the US. And he's sort of threatening Europe with further sanctions in the form of tariffs if we put further regulation in place. And you know, we have some regulation,
If you look back in recent times, the way European leaders have been tiptoeing around the question of, you know, their attitude to the snatch squad that was sent into Caracas to take out the Venezuelan president and his wife. They're very wary about crossing Donald Trump. So given that, OK, a different context, but can we really expect the European leadership to be very strong in calling the social media companies or the high tech companies to order?
I think we need to look again at children's rights in these digital environments. The UN Convention on the Rights of the Child is very clear that children's digital rights children's rights apply in digital environments just as they do, you know, online as much as they do offline. We also know that, you know, the protection of minors is fundamentally important. And so often we hear that, you know, privacy being pitched against children's safety online, or freedom of expression being pitched against children's safety online. And what we need are solutions that encompass all of it, that children's, you know, protection, their rights are given equal weight rather than being pushed down the pecking order. These companies have to date put their commercial interests over everything else, including child safety. They have, you know, put half-hearted measures. It's like sticking plaster. I call them sticking plaster solutions. They are not fundamental changes that they absolutely need to make to the design of the online environments that they are creating that are causing so many problems to children, like the recommender algorithm, like the fact that they are profiling children and using that information to advertise them, to recommend content to them. It is a deeply problematic model, and it's one that needs to change.
And that is an algorithm that effectively can infiltrate something like Snapchat, which can be a great source of communication for kids if it's used, I suppose, appropriately. But, you know, innocence can be lost very quickly.
Yeah, Snapchat's an interesting model because it is enormously popular. It's with children and young people. It's slightly dropped off in popularity with the under 13s, interestingly, over the last 3 or 4 years. But it is still popular. I think something like 25% of under 13s, according to our data, had a Snapchat account. But it has a minimum age rating of 13, which it's decided on itself based on a US law called COPPA. But this, again, I think we need to be scrutinizing these age ratings based on risk, because to my mind, the model that it offers, especially around connections, you know, when you go into that app, the first thing it'll do is recommend all these connections that you can quick add. And oftentimes, as I said, they're kind of your network, but also your network's network. So they're, if you are a bad actor and you want to access children, you know, there are certain places you know that are going to make it easier for you to do so. And we also know that children, because we survey children about this, that they will accept friend requests. They're much more likely to accept a friend of a friend request because there is some familiar, oh, well, my friend is friends with them, so they must be fine kind of thing. But actually, when you delve into it, they don't know them. They don't know them offline at all. So it is really risky. And the things like that, the design of that app should work against it. If you want to have a minimum age rating of 13, you have to prove that you are safe and appropriate. So we need to look at all the features. Do they have an AI chatbot? Snapchat does. WhatsApp does. You know, is this entirely accessible to children? If so, can you disable that feature for under 13, say, or do we need to ensure that that's given a higher age rating? Because at the moment, you can't disable, you can disable it on Snapchat now. You couldn't initially, but there is now a parental control that enables you to disable it. But on Meta's AI, it's not possible to, you can ignore it, but you can't disable it.
And then you have, I suppose, the dismissive attitude of somebody like Elon Musk, the owner of the X platform, where something like the Grok facility is available, and it can be used in a very sinister way to, if you like, undress people or their images. And he doesn't appear to be all that concerned about it. Even though he's sort of saying to people, oh, well, you shouldn't use any of my apps, or you shouldn't use any of my facilities to do anything that's illegal.
I think we should, you know, in the Online Health Task Force report recommendations, which were published in December, one of the options that was suggested in it was the ability to geo-block. You know, if a service is not complying, that we should have the potential to geo-block them from Ireland, you know, from people
in Ireland.
Is
there any example, though,
until
of that,
they change?
Are there any precedents that you can point to elsewhere? I mean, is there something like that happening in Italy, for instance?
Brazil, I think, geo-blocked X for a time. It is possible to do this. And so what Italy is passing legislation around access to pornography. So they are basically passing a law, and they're kind of, because we've got these EU harmonization laws, which means that the host country is the one that needs to act on behalf of Europe. So you need to host those. So for example, the providers of commercial porn sites, if they're not based in Ireland, it's very difficult for us to regulate them according to the way we have it set up at the moment. But Italy's kind of getting around that by saying, if it's very clearly directed at an Italian audience, which you can prove through language, through the kind of advertisements and so on, then we will have the power to impose age verification requirements on you. So even if you're not based in the state of Italy. So I think, you know, we need to be looking, and I believe that they got approval for their approach from the European Commission, because different countries, Spain, France, Italy, are all exploring options about how they can block access to this content. The UK's done it, but obviously they're not based in Europe. So we all have to work within these harmonization rules. But to my mind, if it's possible, like Italy is showing, if you can prove that it is directed at an Irish audience or an Italian audience, that then you can impose these requirements, we should do it.
Is one of the consequences of Brexit that youngsters in the UK, including Northern Ireland, are maybe better protected than their counterparts in this state?
Well, yeah, I mean, that is the reality. The UK passed its Online Safety Act and was able to move very quickly in terms of putting in place age verification requirements and blocking access to underage children. So if you're north of the border today and you're a child, in theory, it's a lot harder for you to access this kind of content than it is in a child south of the border, which is crazy. And, you know, OK, so none of the commercial porn providers have their headquarters here in Ireland. They might have other, you know, I believe ILO, which provides the likes of Pornhub, have other offices here dealing with payroll, for example, but they're not legally headquartered here. You know, we seem to not be able to impose requirements on them. So we need to look at, I do think we should be looking at what other countries, Spain, Italy, France are doing in this area, and looking at what we can do in the national context to, and urgently. This is not something that we should be considering over years. It's urgent.
We've been talking so far really in a kind of a macro context, Alex, and I could imagine somebody listening to this and saying, my God, you know, if I had to wait for governments or Europe or the UN or whoever to fix all this, you know, it'll never happen. Our children will be into old age. So coming back to what individual parents and families and educators can do, I mean, where does CyberSafe Kids come in? What can you do, or what advice do you have? Because, you know, people will feel, look, this is my responsibility now. Great if government can help, but in the meantime, there are children growing.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, our website is a great place to start, right? We've loads of resources. We've a digital parenting guide on our website, which is available to download, or you can just flick through it on our website. We've a gadget gift guide, which is looking at all the different devices available to children, because we're monitoring through our survey data what devices children are using, kind of the levels of popularity. So actually a tablet is the most popular smart device that a child under the age of 13 will be using or will have. So we've got advice around, you know, what are some of the risks involved with devices? What are the opportunities? What are the parental controls you can apply? I mean, if you were to drill it down into the kind of key things, conversations are like the most important thing you could be doing all the way through, whether you have an 8-year-old or a 16-year-old, talking about it, normalizing conversations around it are really important. Keeping that channel of communication open and reminding them, if anything goes wrong online, if you see anything that makes you feel uncomfortable, come and talk to me. And without that threat that everything's going to be taken away from them immediately, because of course that will put them off telling you. And we know lots of children, again, from our survey data, are not telling their parent or trusted adult when things go wrong. So that encouragement that we'll work through it together is so important. Putting in place ground rules is another great thing to do, and considering whether or not you can follow them yourself as the parent or carer in that household. So device-free times, like meal times, maybe there's one meal a day where you sit around the dinner table and nobody has their device at the table. Device-free zones, so we talk about bedrooms particularly. So many kids tell us that they are allowed to keep their devices in their bedrooms overnight. And that is so problematic from so many different angles. You know, at a minimum, it's a disruptor to sleep. But, you know, beyond that, the parental carer is really excluded from what they're doing in their bedroom overnight. What are they looking at? Who are they talking to? How long are they spending? Is stuff upsetting them? Because again, they're probably not going to come forward if they weren't supposed to be on the device in the first place. So make it easier on everybody and keep all devices out of the bedroom overnight.
And I think, was there a figure in your survey published last September that something like, was it 3/4 of teenagers were saying, look, their parents don't really know what they're looking at?
Yeah. You know, like there's huge independence that children have, even from a young age. And that's our focus, is that more independent access. And especially when they're in primary school, parents really need to be alongside them. Keep them where you can see them, you know, kitchen, living room, you know, where you can more easily kind of look over the shoulder or check in with them.
It's a bit more difficult though as kids get older, say once they get to 14, 15.
It does. And I'm a parent of teenagers these days. So I always joke that now I'm in the front lines on this one. But again, just having those rules around keeping the devices out of the bedroom. And I don't just say overnight. I say in general, you're not allowed to bring them into the bedroom. Keep laptops even out of the bedroom. It drives my husband crazy, but the kids do their homework at the kitchen table, you know. But it's just, again, an easier way to check in with them. And I know it can be challenging. So keeping the rules as simple as possible is important. The other thing I would say is, it's a bit like we started out, but, you know, go and look for information. If your child is coming home and saying they want to play Roblox or Minecraft, or they want a Snapchat account, go and look up what the experts say about these different apps and games. There's brilliant advice on places like Common Sense Media, which is a US website, but they do reviews. They do app, movie, game reviews. They give an age appropriate, their view on, okay, so there's the official age rating, but they give their view on whether or not that's the realistic rating. You get the parents' review of it. So I think that webwise.ie in the Irish context also provides really good content and resources for parents, for educators. And then, aside from parents, we also need to look at equipping children for growing up in a digital age through our education system. And we do have some content within the curriculum under kind of media literacy, which falls under SBHE. But it's not enough. It's, you know, so often we'll talk to kids and they'll say, oh, it's, you know, it's a year or two or longer since we had a conversation about this. We need to be really embedding this across the curriculum. There's a very good model in Finland. So Finland decided, I think it was about 10 or 12 years ago, Russia is obviously their neighbour, and they knew there was active interference in their elections. So they wanted to upskill every citizen to be able to spot fake news, mis and disinformation, to be kind of approaching this with a more kind of critical thinking lens. So they have this cradle to the grave approach, and that takes in the education system. So they've embedded this across the curriculum. So you could be in an English lesson looking at persuasive language. You could be in an art class looking at, you know, propaganda tools through imagery, which is all the more, mm-hmm. you know, with deepfake technology, it's all the more vital with the massive flow of mis and disinformation across, you know, the online world, including the new AI tools, because, of course, it's just based on a sweep of what's already out there. We really need users to be much more discerning about what they're encountering, and we need to be fostering that through our education system.
The Wall Street Journal reported fairly recently, around the turn of the year, on a survey by a Boston Children's Digital Wellness Lab, a survey of 1,500 teens, and some 63% said they admitted that they used their phones too much. Now, is there anything in your own research that would mirror that here?
Yeah, we asked the children the same thing, like, how do you feel about the time that you're spending online? 50% of the children under the age of 13 said they spent too much time online. I think it's closer to, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's something like 60% of 12 to 15-year-olds felt that they were spending too much time online. Interestingly, for the under 13s, so 50% said they felt they spent too much time online, 25% said they found it difficult to switch off. But when we asked them the question, do your parents think you spend too much time online? Only 40% said yes. So 50% said they themselves felt they spent too much time online, but only 40% felt that their parents would say. And I think that points to a bit of a divide there between kind of what parents think they know about what their children are doing online or encountering online, and what children are actually doing and encountering online. You know, so we do need to bridge that gap. And it is very difficult. And there was some really interesting research published in 2025 by Block W and ESRI in Ireland, which considered 4,000 different pieces of research, international research. And they concluded, and it was focused on parenting in the digital age, and they concluded that a lot of parents themselves are suffering, are struggling to mediate their own technology use, but also that even with all the best digital parenting approach in the world, it's still going to require more. Like, we still do need that reform within those online environments.
What about the whole question of detox? I mean, you read some suggestions that it leads to a reduction in depression symptoms, less anxiety, less insomnia. I mean, what's your view of that? How practical is it to think in terms of detoxing?
I think healthy digital habits are really, you know, that kind of mindfulness around our digital habits is really important. We run this campaign every year called Cyber Break. It's a 24-hour break from devices, and it's like a challenge. Can you do it? We start at 5 p.m. on Friday and we finish at 5 p.m. on Saturday. And it's designed to kind of for families, right? So the idea is that children go home and encourage their own parents. Like when we first started doing this, my kids were much smaller. And I remember literally the first year we did it, I was trying to send out a tweet, as it was Twitter back then, to say, OK, I'm switching off for 24 hours. And my kids were wrestling it out of my hands, saying, you promised you'd put this down, you know, and it's now 5 o'clock. And I'm like, but I want to send this one more tweet. So it is really important that we are more mindful about our technology use. But I think it's against a backdrop of really addictive design. It is deliberately designed to hold our attention for as long as possible. There is a reason why it's difficult to put down, is it difficult to look away. There's so many features, you know, whether it's the notifications, whether it's the continuous scroll, whether it's the likes, there are so many features that keep us. And of course, there's that recommender algorithm working away in the background, sending more and more content that's going to hold our attention. So we are working against a very challenging backdrop. And the more that we challenge that model, you know, so we've got the Digital Services Act sort of tackles this for children. So in its guidelines that were published this summer in terms of how to interpret the section on protection of minors, it talks about prioritizing explicitly stated interests of children over kind of inferred data that they've gathered through profiling. But I mean, the language doesn't really lend itself to real reform. When you talk about prioritizing, how will you prove that they didn't prioritize? So to my mind, in my simplistic way, I think it needs to be black and white. You cannot profile children. You cannot send them recommendations based on their age, their gender, their location, their sexual orientation. You know, that is what's happening. And it, you know, we kind of say in various different ways, in various different laws, oh, this shouldn't be happening. But unless we are explicitly clear that they cannot and will face heavy fines if they don't, it will continue to happen.
I read somewhere that you and your co-founders, Cliona and Maggie, had the idea that you would shut down this charity or shut it down once your objectives had been achieved. And so when is it going to be shut down?
Yeah, I think we rather naively said, oh, we'll do this for as long as we'll bridge the gap for as long as it's needed. And yeah, in 10 years on, I feel, unfortunately, the need is all the greater. I feel even more passionately today that we urgently need to do far more to protect children online than we are currently doing, than I did even on day one. You know, I knew that it was coming and there was a gap. And I'd love to say that we would be shutting our doors in 2 years or 5 years, you know, but I think it's a challenging landscape. My hope is that within 10 years, let's say, and I've been saying that for about 3 years, so I have to keep adding to it. But yeah, I hope in 10 years, this will all look a lot different. I feel that a whole generation of children has already been negatively impacted by the design of this technology in particular. It's the design it comes back to, you know, so we can ban them, we can restrict access, we can do all those things. But unless we fundamentally redesign so that it's more safe and appropriate for children and use things like age verification solutions to restrict access to more inappropriate content, you know, we're going to continue to see the fallout. And we don't even really understand the fallout and what, you know, there's, you know, what is the actual impact?
What's coming across your desk by way or down the line to you by way of contacting people about the fallout? What are you seeing or hearing?
Well, I suppose what we're doing is trying to keep an eye on what children are actually doing online and what's changing in that. So, for example, last year, we really highlighted this shift, this increased access to AI chatbots. This was something new that we'd seen. We'd asked the children the question the year before, and the numbers were low. So children in primary and secondary school were both reporting in fairly low numbers that they were engaging with AI chatbots. This year it was different. It was 26% of the 8 to 12-year-olds, and it was 36% of the 12 to 15-year-olds, which was a really significant jump. Now, largely they were saying they were using it for things like homework checks to look up information. but in some cases it was just to chat. And we know from other studies, so for example, carried out by the UK body Internet Matters, that there are more vulnerable children who see this technology as a friend, you know, these chatbots as a friend. And indeed, it's designed in that way. And there are so few guardrails. And in some cases, there have actually even been suicides, you know, where it has been alleged that the chatbot has led a child or a young adult, actually, there's various pending cases in the US at the moment, to take their own life. So there's the Adam Rain case in the US, which involves ChatGPT, where it's alleged that the chatbot mentioned the word suicide 6 times more than he did. And this started out with, again, simple homework searches. That's what he was using it for. And it evolved very quickly into something far darker. There's another case of a 14-year-old boy who took his own life. He was engaging with an AI chatbot through character.ai. And again, according to his mother, he never mentioned the word suicide at all. He did talk about self-harming, but he never talked about suicide. And that idea was put into his head through this conversation. Because again, like so much of this technology, it is designed to keep us on. It's designed to keep us engaged. So it's going to say whatever to keep that conversation going. And in the case of Adam Rain on ChatGPT, like, he did talk about seeking help, you know, maybe leaving out evidence so that his mum would know what he was thinking. And again, I can only go off what I've seen, but the evidence suggests that he was discouraged from doing so. So I think we should be really concerned about this, you know, evolution of the technology. You know, it's not about stymieing innovation, but it is about putting appropriate guardrails in place.
We spent virtually all our time talking about the companies and what's available. What about the use that people are making of it? I mean, I'm thinking particularly, say, of cyberbullying, which is a problem we've known about for quite a while. And that's not so much the companies or the providers as the users. And it can be a very difficult space for a youngster to find him or herself in, you know, if they're being subject to cyberbullying.
Yeah, and it's a shift away from the more traditional forms of bullying, which, you know, people would say kind of finished when the school day finished. You know, if there were bullies in the schoolyard, you know, at least when you went home, it was a safe place. And the big difference here is that it's a more ongoing, and, you know, one comment could end up being the source of, you know, because it can be, you know, added to, it can be shared, it can be, you know, or one photo or one video can be the source of a bullying campaign. And also, you know, what we're trying to educate children on in the classroom is to, you know, think about what is lost in online communication. So, of course, children are using all sorts of different communication platforms online to communicate with one another. And it is part of growing up in a digital age, and they love it. And it's not about necessarily taking all that away, but we do need to work a lot harder to help them understand the importance of communicating with respect and empathy and kindness, and not sharing stuff without the consent of the other person. Because you do lose a lot in online communications. Like, if I say something to you over this table, you hear my tone, you can see my facial expression, you can probably determine whether or not I'm joking. You know, like, we infer a lot from the way it's delivered to us. You lose all that online. That empathy piece is really gone. So something, we had a case where a boy said to a girl, like, she posted a selfie saying something like, "Oh, I look really ugly today." And he said, "Oh, you know, you're just looking for attention." And then all these other kids piled in saying, "Yeah, you're such an attention seeker." And it became this real problem, and then school had to deal with it. And it, you know, had he said that as a throwaway line in the schoolyard, maybe it wouldn't have, because others wouldn't have been able to jump on it in the same way. It wouldn't have had that kind of longevity. So, you know, it is a very different contest, and he wouldn't have ended up in as much hot water as he eventually did. Or, you know, there was another case that we had where kids in primary school, and I think these were like 10 or 11 year old girls, and they set up a WhatsApp group called, you know, We Hate, and the name of the child who was excluded. You know, so let's say she was Susie, We Hate Susie. And Susie knew that there was a group called We Hate Susie and that all these other kids were in it. And, you know, or there's the most common experience that children tell us about is being left out, because, you know, you've got features like the Snap Maps feature on Snapchat, which shows you exactly where your friends are. So, you know, I remember a parent telling me about her daughter had suggested to her friends after a match, let's go to McDonald's. They all said, oh no, we're busy. You know, she checks her Snap Maps half an hour later, they're all in McDonald's and she's at home. You know, it's a very obvious kind of feeling of being excluded from something. So yes, technology facilitates this behavior. We are going to have to work a lot harder at educating kids on the consequences of sharing stuff online or saying stuff online.
You must hear some very good things though as well.
We know that we talk to children all the time and they are really enthusiastic about it. And that is the challenge, right? And I know we spend so much time talking about the kind of negative side of it, obviously, because that's what we encounter and we're trying to kind of look at the risks and address the risks. But the reality is children are growing up in a digital age, and it isn't about saying that children should never be online. It's about saying that children should be safe and protected online or should be able to thrive online. So what do we need to put in place to ensure that that happens? We know that children don't want the technology all taken away, but there are things that they don't like about it. They talk about seeing rude content, for example, that they don't want to see, or people contacting them that they don't want to contact them, or, you know, experiences in online environments that they would rather hadn't happened. You know, we talked to a 7-year-old in a focus group about being in Roblox and being locked in a basement trying to get away from a man who kept trying to take his clothes off, and how scary it was. And you can imagine how terrifying it was. But, you know, she just wanted to play the game, and she wanted, you know, and this was really taking away from the enjoyment of that game. So what we want is that children can participate in the online world, but that there are much more checks and balances there to enable them to have these safe and positive experiences. And of course, they're going to be online environments we don't want children in.
Alex Cooney, Chief Executive and Co-Founder of CyberSafe Kids, thank you so much and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
If you've been affected by any issues raised in this podcast, please visit rte.ie/helplines. You can find more insights with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio Player or wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you for listening.